The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
First, I want to say welcome back to Philadelphia. You have been here many times before.
I have indeed.
And we're really grateful to have you back. And we're just going to dive right in. So this book is called Gulp Adventures On, not in, on the
not
Elementary
in
Canal.
Not in and not along.
And
there's
not along.
A matter of some debate.
And this
with
is important.
My publisher.
Because I did some man on the street type of polling, and I asked some people, when I say Elementary Canal, what do you think? And you may or may not be surprised how many people thought it was that place in Panama where the boats go through. So I think we need to clear the air as it is. And Mary, what is the Alimentary Canal?
Okay, the Alimentary Canal. Basically, the pie hole, the food chute. The whole human donut hole from one end to the other.
That's so from soup to nuts as it is.
From soup to nuts. Exactly. Okay. Exactly right. The whole shebang. The whole 9 yards. It's more or less 9 yards, is it not?
30-odd feet.
Okay, yeah.
In an adult.
But that phrase does not come from there.
No,
it doesn't.
It should.
I'm just gonna say that it does.
All right. So we've already decided it's a 30-foot long tube of pulsating, undulating, juicy goodness. Yes. And what we're going to do is from secretion to excretion and everything in between.
She is good.
I try. We're actually have an official pun counter for this evening, but feel free to keep track, and we'll see how many we actually get to.
And we're counting intentional and unintentional, because I did
Absolutely.
Two. I did two unintentional.
All right. Yes.
Earlier today.
Exactly.
Yes. The moving story that I told.
Precisely.
I know.
So we're going to actually start at the top and work our way down. We have props. I mean, how many book interviews do you have when you can actually say there is a stomach on the table? And we have actually, after we're done and you come up, we'll have other fun things to show too, and they're all relevant somewhat to the book. So we can't talk about digestion and the digestive process without first talking about food. It all starts with food. And I think you can really classify people into two categories: those who eat to live and those who live to eat. I personally definitely fall in that latter category, but I want to know where do you stand on this issue, and has the years of research on this book changed your feelings towards food?
I'm definitely of the live to eat category.
Right.
There's no food that I object to on principle or any mm-hmm. other reason. The chapter that did interfere a little bit with my enjoyment of food was the oral processing chapter. This was I was over in the Netherlands, Food Valley, where it's like 17,000 food scientists committed to making your food either better or worse, depending on your feeling about processed food. So there are folks, the science of oral processing, there's not a lot of. This is a very small branch of science. It deals essentially with bolus formation and chewing and swallowing. So if you, I have in my head facts like I know the minimum number of chews that is necessary to render a McVitie's biscuit ready for swallowing.
Which is
8. And I tried
Remember
to. It's,
that.
It's true. It's very hard to do it in under 8. I tried. I've seen videos of intraoral bolus rolling, which is not a pretty thing to see.
But a great name for a band.
I think just bolus.
Bolus.
Yeah. Opening for Slayer.
Oh, that's great. So perfect. Leads right into saliva.
Yes.
The good, the bad, the stinky. Now, I did not realize that saliva, once it exits your body, can actually become very smelly. I mean, I didn't...
Yeah, well, I was over in the lab of this beautiful Italian woman, Erica Saletti, and she's dedicated her career thus far to the study of saliva. And which I don't know, when you think of a saliva researcher, I don't know what you picture, but I didn't really picture Erica Saletti.
Sophia Loren in the lab coat, kind of?
sort of, yes. Excellent boots and a gray, you know, nice wool skirt, dove gray sweater. Very classy woman. And in her lab, the only thing that would cue you in that this was a saliva lab, the world's largest paper towel holder. Enormous, freestanding, on the floor, paper towel holder. But anyway, what was the quote? Saliva. Something about saliva.
Let's go. There's something about spit.
Oh, okay, you were saying, yeah. All right, yes. Well, there are two kinds. When you chew, it's called stimulated saliva, and no matter what you chew, also, it doesn't have to be food, because we were chewing the salivate saliva collection system, which is essentially a... Well, she's Italian, so it was il tampone. It's a cotton plug. And you chew it, and you get... it's amazing. All the saliva comes forth. Even though it's not food, your body is just going like, okay, you're going to take down a tampon. That's fine. We are here. We are here to help you. We're going to moisten that sucker, and you will get that down. So we're chewing, and it's absorbing the saliva. And then she puts it in a centrifuge and spins it. And then you have this little beaker of stimulated saliva. And she said, I'm going to go get some ice because this is going to start to smell relatively soon. Years ago, I visited Hilltop Research, which is where the testing is done of anti-odor products, cat litter, mouthwash, deodorant. So and that's a very strange refrigerator there at Hilltop Research. And I asked Jack Wild, who's the head of Hilltop Research, I said, what is the worst thing you've ever smelled? And without hesitating, he said, yeah, that it would be the incubated saliva. And but the thing with saliva is it has these amazing antibacterial properties.
Right.
It's also got histatins, which apparently speed wound closure. There have been these bizarre tests where they'll... one wound and another. These are animal studies, and if the animal can't lick the wound, it heals more slowly. I mean, so it's this both cesspool of bacteria and a miraculous bacteria fighter. It's a very kind of schizo substance, saliva.
And as a lot of mothers in the audience might know, it really actually is a good cleaner. Now, it has those enzymes, right?
Yes.
Enzymatic action?
Okay, yes. Laundry detergent... There's soaps and things too. There's detergent, yeah. But the stain fighting enzymes, lipase, amylase, proteinase. These are digestive enzymes. So laundry detergent is basically a digestive tract in a box.
That's great.
And it makes sense because the things that you put in your mouth are also the things you drop on your clothes.
That's true.
So
I have built-in stain fighters. You know, forget that Tide stick.
Who needs the Tide pen? And I did. I spilled coffee on my skirt on the plane out here. I have a belief that yes, exactly. I went like this.
It's like, what is somebody live tweets Mary Roach is on a plane licking her skirt. Hey, but so there's no correlation. Have they done any scientific studies that pushing a fetus out of yourself kind of makes you more of a stain-fighting power of your saliva? Or can we actually put to rest here that everybody's saliva is equally good? It's not just mothers.
Well, I will say, okay, art conservators will make use of saliva. Okay, they'll moisten. They have a little stick with some cotton on it, and they'll moisten it with saliva and do some fine work. Because if you have something, a delicate surface that something stronger would damage, mm-hmm. saliva is a very gentle cleanser. And I asked her, this woman, I asked this woman who's the head of the Art Conservators Association or something, I said, is some people's saliva much better? And she said, yeah, it is. So much so that we wondered how many martinis they were having at lunch. Because was there something else going on?
That's alcohol solvency that maybe adds it to the
there's a tremendous amount of variation, and you have different minerals in your saliva and different levels of salt. So much so that if you have a lot of salt, you're less sensitive to salt that you eat because your baseline is saltier. So I said to Erica Saletti, we had these little beakers of beautiful saliva there because the stimulated saliva, it's 90% water, 99% water with some other little things in there. But so there are these little beakers, and she said, yes, everybody's has a different mineral content. I said, oh, so it's like different mineral waters from different springs. So you could do a sort of taste test. And she said, well, you could if you wanted to. And we had these two beakers there, and she's like, no.
Imagine running the NSF grant for that one. Get it? I mean, that's an Ig Nobel award right there. You know, that's something I could see
exactly
happening. So, all right, we're going to have to move on, but I have one more question about saliva. This is actually an anthropological question here. You know, in some cultures, one of the worst things you could possibly do is spit on somebody or even spit in their general direction.
Right.
But yet in other places, like Greece, and you mentioned that in the book, one of the most wonderful things you could do is to spit on somebody. They spit on their babies, on their brides. It's a, both a protection.
Although, as your colleague, Evie pointed out, no actual gob is launched.
Right.
It's more of a...
Okay.
Yeah, but right, no.
It, but the intent, I'm sure at some point somebody's going to let it fly, you know, and that would be theoretically okay.
I think it's probably it's not like American tourists coming over to Greece and trying to fit in and actually spitting on people.
I mean, we should clarify, if you go into Greece, do not hock a loogie on somebody in that from that area. That I don't think that's going to fly. I mean, Evie, is that right? I mean, we shouldn't
That's a pun,
that, right?
there's a pun. It's not going to fly.
What? This could be a drinking game for the people that are doing this, looking at the tweets from back there. So it's good, it's bad, it's certain things to certain people.
Well, it's the taboo related to saliva I found fascinating because while it's in, it's the substance that is part of you, and while it's in your mouth, you have no objection to it whatsoever.
Right.
You are drinking your own saliva, but the second it leaves your mouth, you're disgusted. And there was even a study, it was a Philadelphia researcher, Paul Rosen, who did a study where he had people imagine their favorite bowl of soup. How likely are you to enjoy this? Scale of 1 to 10, very high. And then, okay, same bowl of soup. Now imagine spitting in that bowl of soup. It's
your
own saliva.
Spit.
Your own. And it like is like 2% of people would be like, no, I'm not going to. I won't go near that. It's like, but it's your own. So that's sort of, and then Rosen did this wonderful study on the microanatomy of the self, because you could sort of plot at what point, okay, on the lips, are you okay with it on the lips?
Yeah.
What about if food is on the tongue and you stick out the tongue now? Is it disgusting and you bring it back? No. All right, so you have like dotted lines over where is the self? When does, at what point does saliva go from being me, excellent, I love it, I swallow it, to the most disgusting thing in the world?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. All right, moving down.
Moving down.
We've got 30 feet to cover here, and unfortunately not much time. They're not giving me as much time as I'd like. So it's okay. The stomach. All right. A muscular sac of hydrochloric acid is in every one of us. And hydrochloric acid, if you've ever had the joy of spilling some of it on you in a lab accident, is in moderate quantities not so bad, but in larger quantities is not pleasant. But we have this stomach, it's full of this acid. How do we not digest ourselves?
I know, because haggis, tripe.
We eat stomach.
You eat stomach, you digest it.
You digest it.
My understanding is that we do. In fact, that it's the lining of the stomach regenerates quickly. The other thing going on is that some of these, it's either the acid or the enzyme, but they're produced kind of like epoxy is in two tubes, separated, because if they were together, it would glue itself shut. So
if
you were a cell whose job was to produce this very caustic substance, you'd be like, I can't do it. You're dissolving me. Okay, bye. So it's done separate part components that then come together.
Right.
That's my understanding, yes.
And when we as a species were starting to learn about anatomy, you know, we have the Vesalius and Galen and John Hunter.
Yeah.
And so he was dissecting these corpses, and he was noticing that with alarming frequency, he was cutting them open, and they all had these serious stomach problems.
Lesions.
Or did they? These lesions. So it turns out that, you know, immediately upon death, that's it, game over. It's time for the acid to take over, and so you start to self-digest.
And initially he thought, oh, these lesions must have killed these people. It's some horrible stomach ailment.
Right.
But then he realized young men who had been in bar fights were coming and had been whacked over the head. It was like clearly that was what killed the guy, and yet here were these strange lesions. And he realized, oh, all right, I see what's going on. The person's dead. They're no longer regenerating. So the stomach. So the what's the only thing going on was the dissolving. So they were dissolving their own stomachs.
Well, was it the only thing going on? Because now we're going to kind of continue on to one of my new favorite words, biomass. Doesn't sound
biomass. It sounds almost religious.
It does.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we can get to rectal exorcism if we have the time. But this is that's. That's later on. But biomass, and this
she's
is
not
something.
Kidding either.
No. I don't need to kid with material like this. It just comes forth naturally.
Number two.
Intentional or unintentional, you decide. So biomass. I will say that there's quite a few things about the human body that I know. But one of the things I didn't know is that not only are we not alone in and of ourselves, but we are vastly outnumbered. And you're 1 to 9. So picture this. For every one human cell that is in your body, you have 9 cells of otherness, of other material that is not human. And so tell me, like,
bacteria,
what is that otherness?
Viruses, yeah.
What is that otherness? What is this extra biomass? What is it doing?
It's to the extent. I interviewed. I spent some time with a researcher in Minneapolis who's done a lot of. Well, the polite word is bacteria therapy. The less euphemistic term is fecal transplants, which are very effective cures for us chronic C. difficile infection. But we had this conversation about the microbiome or biomass. This tremendous number, seething number of organisms inside you.
Yeah.
And he said it's not correct to think of them as inside you or part of you. They are an organ. They are a functional human organ. He said it's kind of a philosophical question. Who owns whom?
Who owns whom? Right. So if you think about it, I mean, there's 3 pounds of stuff on and in you that is not you. That's this biomass. So think of that, 3 pounds. If you lost all your biomass right now, you'd be 3 pounds lighter. But you would also probably be dead.
Yeah, no,
let's face
right.
Because we're like this gut flora, you know, and we'll go on to the fecal transplantation soon. But I mean, to talk about the fact that we have these,
and
you
we
know,
even have a C.
We do
a stuffed C. diff.
We have a stuffed
bacteria.
C. diff, because when you get too much C. diff, you get this one, which is diarrhea. But when they all work together, when things are going well, we've got this wonderful gut flora. And what does it do for us? How does it keep us?
Well, there's a tremendous number of things that are just being discovered about the importance of gut flora, but they can be even to the extent of determining certain behaviors, obviously breaking down the waste, the composting. They're doing some basic composting, breaking down of the stuff that the small intestine doesn't absorb and passes on to the composter. And that creates some nutrients, mm-hmm. More so in other animals, but mm-hmm. So they're doing that, and there's a tremendous amount of kind of infighting, and I'm sure that I wish you could make a documentary of what it was like on any given day inside there.
I'm sure they put cameras everywhere. I think we need to get on this. Yeah, or in
well, there
this,
there are now. There are pill cams. They're not. Yeah,
right. Absolutely. Well, that I mean, so these gut flora bacteria, are they the culprits behind that dreaded word that people you have it in hushed whispers, flatus? Now when I say flatus, do you know what I'm talking about?
Flatus.
I'm not
yes.
talking about der flater mouse or flatus mouse. I'm talking about,
and also the thing that I get it confused with, when I was doing the stomach chapter, I came upon the world's record holder for the highest number of Mexican flautas consumed.
Oh, just there's a correlation between that. I think we can all agree.
I never before had noticed the connection between flautas and flatus, but I'm sure that Ben Monson, the record holder of, has noticed that.
So passing gas, flatus, farts.
But yes, bacteria. Yes, your gas is their gas. Yeah. They've created it for you by breaking things down, processing. It's the you know metabolites of bacteria breaking down, in some foods more so than others. The oligosaccharides, that's the culprit in beans, legumes. That's the big gas producer that everybody's familiar with.
Right. I do have to say, in the minimal amount of research I did to prepare for this, I found a term that I absolutely loved. It was a friend's grandmother who referred to them as panty burps. So I think panty burps. I think that's a lovely thing. We should all go out now and just use that term. But I mean, you do talk about the war of the sexes in the flatus battle.
Oh yes.
Yes. So I mean, like, can we again? You know, we're trying to like get, you know, trying to air everything out here. if you so, or should clear the air, I don't know, and say, whose flatus is worse? Is it men's or is it women's?
Well, so, that depends on if you're talking about volume or smell.
Or your husband or, you know.
My mother-in-law or my husband.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, and the thing is, though, okay, with my mother-in-law, my mother-in-law is holding it in. Mm-hmm. You will know, no one has ever heard this woman fart. She's 88 years old, and no one has heard her fart, which means she's holding in. But what happens if you hold it in, presumably, more of it's going to be absorbed, because a certain amount of that gas is absorbed into the bloodstream and exhaled. And in flatulence research, the way they gauge whether you are a producer, that is to say you make enough gas to be in the study, the way they gauge that is with a Mylar bag, and it's not attached here, which I assumed it would be.
You would think.
You blow into it because you can extrapolate from the amount of hydrogen on your breath. You can extrapolate how much you're expelling.
You were willing to go there. I mean, you were willing to take one for science, as it were, right?
I am a producer. Yeah. I will say, I believe my husband though is an executive producer. He's not here, so I can say that.
You did mention in your book that you were worried about the correlation between cold weather, Brussels sprout season, and season and sleeping with your head under the covers. And I did want to tell you there's actually a term for that, is to be Dutch ovened.
So yes,
it can also be called a covered wagon. I think it's depending on the east or west of the Mississippi. So there you go. So I don't know if you think we've covered panty burps.
Well, I should say hydrogen sulfide. Yeah. Which is the main
not a laughing matter.
Not a laughing matter. Hydrogen sulfide in a noxious release,
yes,
let's say, it's about 2 to 3 parts per million when when it's the rotten egg smell. But at 1,000 parts per million, it's lethal, causes respiratory paralysis, and it can kill you. I mean, so when I was studying this, and I was in this lab where they were doing studies with some fairly scary amounts, started thinking about those cold nights when my Brussels sprout, being a winter vegetable that's produced, there's a lot of sulfur compounds, and I'm under the cover with, and I thought, am I in danger of of respiratory paralysis? My poor husband would have killed me.
and then somebody
she's
would
dead.
Have to write
I
that
have
obituary,
no idea.
You know?
What?
Death by panty burps.
Death by panty burps.
I mean, that's just not the way that you want to go. So I think now there's a perfect segue. I mean, prior to this, we were talking about the wondrous mechanisms of the alimentary canal, all the wonderful things about it. Let's talk about when good colons go bad. So let's take a 180 and talk about the things that can go wrong in your alimentary canal. Because, of course, that leads us to your pilgrimage to the Mutter Museum. And there we have a very special...
unreal.
Friend.
Unreal.
Unreal.
It is as big around as I am. It's 28 inches in diameter.
It's 28 inches in diameter.
It's like basically right here.
This would be what we affectionately refer to as the megacolon. And it's walking distance away. If you want to take it's closed now.
It's an extraordinary. And I also just love that it's in the beautiful, wood and glass vitrine with the special museum lighting.
Absolutely.
And it is kind of beautiful in its own hideous way.
Right.
Now, it looks like in Dune, the worms.
The worm in Dune, I've had some people go, does it produce spice? Like, not anymore. So this is the result of something called Hirschsprung's disease, and you talk about it in your book a little bit, and talk about, basically this is something that, we're going to talk about, things that happen from birth. So this is more of a congenital defect.
Right.
And
right.
So tell us a little bit about how you can get megacolon, and this will lead us also into the king. We'll talk about him a little bit later.
Yeah. Elvis. Well, Hirschsprung's, people with Hirschsprung's, my understanding is they, as one gastroenterologist said to me, they basically come out of the box that way. It's the far end of the colon. The nerves don't get laid down, mm-hmm. so the wonderful contractions that move stuff along aren't working, so everything backs up. And they and you get these... backups that are stretching the colon out. It gets flabby. It doesn't work right. You get these, and it just keeps spiraling until you have the situation like it is in the glass case. And Elvis Presley had a megacolon, and he wasn't diagnosed with Hirschsprung's, and nobody was able. By the time that was figured out at his autopsy, when they saw that, I don't have the diameter here, and it's nowhere near.
No, but it was about 3 times the size of a
normal
regular colon,
and impacted with a lot of rock hard stuff. It was a and how he died was straining It was your defecation-associated sudden death situation.
And it was just shocking at how many deaths that's responsible for. I mean,
so much so that in intensive care units, if you have somebody with a weak heart in a sort of a precarious situation, combined with the fact that they're using a bedpan, which is the least efficient way to empty yourself. I mean, you're lying flat, you're not squatting, you're not even sitting.
Right.
So these folks, they'll put them on stool softeners, like just nobody wants to take any chances that there's going to be your defecation-associated sudden death.
Defecation-associated sudden death.
Yes.
Yeah. Nobody wants to go that way.
No.
Or actually, you do want to go that way, you just don't want to go that way.
Oh, God.
Sorry. It's too much. So, yeah, I mean, I should mention that the megacolon at the time of death did have 40 pounds of fecal material in it at the time of autopsy, which is no longer the case. I mean, it's now dried. It's filled with, like, a straw or something now. But you would not believe what people... And again, this goes back to this you know, repulsion that we have of our own waste, in that, you know, they're coming towards the case, and from a distance, you don't even know what it is. And sometimes when you get there, you're like, what is this? Because it doesn't look like a colon.
It looks like maybe a monitor lizard or
something.
Yeah,
it looks like...
That's some kind of...
They read the first sentence and then
armadillo, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, and then they backpedal, I mean, to the point where people... we're a very small museum. I've seen somebody clock their head at the back of the stairs. They could not get away fast enough.
Yeah.
So it's... What is it? I mean, we all do it. I mean, maybe not JW, maybe not megacolon. He was one bowel movement a month.
And JW, he was found dead in the water closet of his eating club. So that was a case of your...
Exactly.
Defecation-associated.
So most of us have this aversion to that particular area of our body, but we do need to talk about its recreational and logistical applications, so to speak. So this just leads me right into this wonderful phrase I'd like to say, which is, tell me about your time in prison.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I have a chapter. I'm making my way down the canal. I found myself in the human rectum. And I thought, well, what would be a because I like to, for every chapter, go somewhere a setting with people and conversation. So I thought, well, who would have an interesting perspective on the rectum, which is basically a storage facility?
It is.
It's a storage facility. You should be glad that you have such a storage facility. I think it's a force for civilized behavior. You don't have to immediately leave, drop what you're doing. You can wait a while.
Yeah.
So I called the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The prison folks, and I said, this is what I'm doing, and I'm writing this kind of biography of the alimentary canal, and I'd like to talk about the tremendous storage capacity of the rectum, and I understand you have some issues with the smuggling of cell phones rectally, and I completely expected to not get a reply, but this man wrote back, and he said, we have had a lot of trouble with contraband, alimentary contraband smuggling, and he said...
Alimentary contraband smuggling, that's awesome.
And he said, I can set someone up for you to talk to, a prisoner, and he said, would 4 hours be enough time? I said, to talk to a stranger about his rectum? I think so. but it was... And I got there, and... they walked me across the yard, and we sat down in someone's office waiting for this guy, who I will call Rodriguez. That's not his real name. But I said to the guy whose office it was, so what is this man in for? And he typed in his name, number, and he turned the monitor to face me, and it says, murder, in, like, blinking lights. And I'm looking at my list of questions, which includes hooping, which is sticking something through the hoop. Might hooping be a form of what the Journal of Homosexuality calls masked anal manipulation? I'm like, cross that off.
Let's ask somebody else that question.
Yeah. So, but anyway, it was a way to address what is kind of a strange thing to be writing about, which is the defecation reflex and manual override of that and the rectum. And so it was a very fruitful afternoon. That wasn't a
productive afternoon.
That wasn't a pun, was it?
That was. What I think is interesting is that I think we're reaching cell phones, I think you said, were one of the number one things that they wanted to get smuggled.
Tobacco and cell phones.
Right. Has anybody noticed as you're going into these cell phone stores now that the phones are getting bigger and bigger? I mean, you cannot get a really small, compact smartphone. And it seems like we're all being forced to get to these smartphones. So I'm wondering if we're going to have some serious contraband issues,
Injuries. A dilemma in the inmate population because there's, of course, a desire to have more features on your phone. But on the other hand, it's more
you want to be able to sit down eventually.
You want to, right. And there were a few very small cell phone models that I'm convinced the only reason they kept making them was that they were so popular in the inmate population that there was, I think, oh my God, these still seem to be selling really well certain parts of the country.
I'm telling you, well, so I like the fact that the hooping, that was one of the terms, but my favorite was keistering.
Yeah, keistering was the other slang for it. And the slang for the rectum in behind bars is the prison wallet. That's what it's
called.
That
makes sense. Yep. That makes sense. And you were saying...
Or just the vault.
Oh. Yeah. But that vault's easily
breached.
Okay, so... So that's more of a logistical, you know, purely practical thing. But there's also a recreational aspect of it as well. And so...
Well, and also practical. Keep going. Go where you're going.
I will go there because that's my job. Brachioproctic eroticism.
Okay.
I mean, we have to use that term.
You know what?
Should we not even define it? Should we just leave them hanging and say, you know, we're not going to define that, but we'll brachioproctic eroticism. So we're just going to say that, and we're going to move on to something completely different,
yes.
And we'll let them Google it, right?
Yeah.
And then we'll start
hearing... But what's interesting is that I know the man who invented that term.
Right, and this brings us to the ass file.
Oh, yeah, the ass file.
The ass box. Well, the ass file, this is something very special.
Yeah, okay.
And this was something that when you came to visit, this was like about 2 years ago,
This is how we got in touch.
Yeah.
It all started with the ass file.
It all started with the ass, and it all ends, really, with the ass file. But this was something that I had to say was the weirdest exchange where you said you were looking for, you know, this type of your kind of research, and I thought, I have got something that she is going to love. And I tell you about the ass file, and you go, oh, I already have it. What? How do you already have the ass file? You went to the doctor himself.
Yes.
Who gave you the ass file, right?
You Xeroxed everything in the ass file.
But not everything.
But not everything.
Remember, he redacted his own ass file. So when she came to visit me, we were comparing ass files. How many times can she say this? So, and we found one article.
Oh, he had redacted. Oh,
he had redacted the concrete enema with ping pong balls.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And the reason I bring this up is because you were talking about prisoners packing for solitary, and they would put a tobacco,
spectacles,
reading glasses, right?
Magazine in one case.
Yeah.
And in one case, altogether. Which I had seen years and years ago on paper on things that had been removed in emergency rooms. And I was puzzled by they called it a collection when it was more than one object, collections. And it was spectacles, magazine, tobacco. I think that was it. And I understood because when you go into solitary, Rodriguez told me, you take your cigarette, your light, your tobacco and your lighters because you're not allowed to take them in. So you use your pocket, your other pocket.
Yeah. And that makes perfect sense. But now, this is unfortunately our final question I can give you right now, which is, can you speculate on the concrete enema with the ping pong balls? Clearly the ping pong balls came first. And so the question is, did this individual, do you think they used the concrete enema to try and get the ping pong balls out? Or what are your personal feelings on this?
You know, I should have read. I don't even think. I think I just looked at the photo and put the paper away.
And that was it. That was it.
I don't know the story behind that. Do you?
No. Not really. I mean, I think it was clinical. They don't care about the backstory, these doctors. They just said, subject presented itself with a concrete enema with two ping pong balls. It was delivered successfully.
Yes,
that's
delivered.
What you're talking
that's
about.
That's right. The verb is usually when something is removed. First of all, when it's in there, sometimes they use incarcerated.
Again, going back to the question before, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. There was a bottle of impulse body spray incarcerated
in
an attorney. And for some reason, they felt the need to say it was an attorney. That was the only occupation they mentioned in any.
Right. So we have all these very academic, brachioproctic articles that talk about these most amazing things that were inserted in, but you're reading this not as a proctologist, a doctor. You're reading this just as a researcher. You go, I want backstory. Ooh, that was
another one.
So, well, unfortunately, we're out of time for our part here. But we didn't even get to rectal exorcism. There's so much. There's a wealth of things. But, you know, we have to open it up to you guys now. So what we're going to do is we've got two wonderful assistants here with microphones. So please raise your hand if you have a question. If you dare. And then please wait for the person with the microphone to come and then ask your question, and we'll go from there. So who's up? Right here, second row.
Hi. You didn't get time, so I'd really like to know, what is a rectal exorcism?
Thank you.
What is what?
The rectal exorcism.
Oh, okay.
What it sounds
exorcists,
like.
There are different ways to apply holy water. You can sprinkle. And you can even, in some cases, drink holy water that people have drink. And there was a case that I came upon where the exorcist had, because enemas were common, it was very popular for centuries. There were beautiful syringes used for them. So there was a case where holy water was applied. It was like a holy water enema, basically, as part of an exorcism. Right. It wasn't a common practice.
Right.
Just a unique approach.
This was a nun, we should mention, a mother
this
superior.
This was a nun. There's a mother superior in France.
She actually was the one to tell the priest that that's where the devil was living.
That's right. That's right. That was his excuse.
Yeah.
Anyway, so and when you think about it, it was a way to get the material.
The direct line
right
of
up inside. Like, why sprinkle when you can get it right on in there, I guess, was the thinking.
That's one way to be closer to God, I guess. But okay. Any other questions? Let's do blue scarf there.
Hi. I'm fascinated by this concept of the pill camera. And what's occurring to me is if you're making some kind of a picture or a video, where's the light coming from? Assume it's dark in there.
Little tiny light source.
Wow, so it's like shining this little light and taking the pictures at the same time all the way.
Yeah, and you know what's amazing, though, is that this technology apparently existed back in the late 50s, 60s, because Masters and Johnson created a penis camera, which was because they wanted to document female sexual arousal from the inside. So they created this phallus with a camera and a light source. And that technology, for that miniaturization
at
that... What?
I saw that in high school, The Miracle of Birth. And they have
a little...
The money shot. Yeah. Yeah.
I guess the technology has been around for a while. But yeah, you can have a little very small light source with your camera. Because, yeah, otherwise it would be very uneventful footage.
Any other questions we have? Gentleman right there.
If there is such a thing as a normal procedure, how long does it take for food once eaten to be evacuated in the human body?
Depends on the food, depends on the person, but 30 hours is a figure I've heard.
About an hour for a foot, I guess. You know.
But we're all different.
I mean, there's just no one time for one person. I mean, we all have... 30 feet is just an average. I mean, so we're all different.
Right, and so, depends on your emotional state.
We didn't talk about the clenching, yeah. And the whole... When people say you have butterflies in your stomach, I mean, there's a reason for that. So you want to talk about a little bit?
What's in the book is more the... When you're really nervous and you have to go. I didn't get into butterflies in the stomach. I don't know specifically.
We all clench.
Yeah, when you're nervous, you clench. And that kind of mimics the squeezing of the rectum. Right.
Which is really not good if you're smuggling drugs in your rectum.
Yes, definitely not the last thing a drug smuggler needs. Yeah.
Right. Okay, good. Any more questions here? More questions? Red sweater, second row? Either one?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So you've talked about the tremendous storage capacity of the rectum. And you've talked about the various things that have been smuggled in the prison wallet. I'm wondering what the total storage capacity is.
We didn't talk about rectal training. Yeah, okay. Rectal training.
Well, in that paper that had the various collections, okay, I'm just going to give you a couple examples. One of them was simply 402 stones. I don't know the size. This is the thing. Why would they give an average stone size? Okay, this is okay. Another collection, lemon and cold cream jar. So, to quote Rodriguez, the rectum will stretch, believe me.
And I believe he also said that sometimes things, quote, get away from you.
Oh, he didn't say that, but
somebody else said that.
Especially if there's any sort of lubricant involved. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, that's one thing that we should mention is that, you know, every hospital has what I affectionately refer to as an ass box. And if you are a doctor and you say, oh, no, there's no such thing as that. No, there is. You just don't know about it. And so we talked about briefly about the, you know, it's amazing the amount of things that people slipped and fell onto, right? It's just amazing.
And there was a case, actually, there was a urethral case where there was three sets of tweezers. And the guy's story was, well, one, I don't know how you've explained the first one, but the second and the third, he said, were to try to get the other ones out.
Right.
However, they were the other way around. So he was busted.
Yeah, that's just, all right. Question.
See what you did, standing way in the back
right there. You opened up something right there.
Yeah, with the increasing rise in cesarean sections. So, that's being blamed for a lot of immunological problems as well as allergies. Do you see, healthcare covering fecal transplants in the future?
Yes. That's it. The healthcare... One moment.
The Marco Rubio
building up
pause.
Some tension. There have been a couple of large studies that have shown like a 90-something percent cure rate for chronic C. diff infection. So things are changing. And people have asked me, is it because it's so gross? Is that why it's taken so long? Because the first one was done in the 80s. And why hasn't it become something? There's no billing code currently for it. Partly because there's no... big pharmaceutical company behind it, no device maker behind it to pay the money to do the test.
It's a man with a brown paper bag who had Kung Pao chicken for dinner.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It's the material is free. There's no, you know, that's. So who pays for the testing and the trials? I mean, you know, getting something approved by the FDA and worked into the system. You know, how do they? What's the code for it? How much do you charge for it? So all of that has also been hard to figure out. And I think also the ick factor has played into it as well. It just seems intuitively.
But you were actually there for a fecal transplant. You went from collection processing to implantation.
Right. So. It's very simple. It's basically the guy with the bag and then another guy with a blender and then the patient. It's very simple. It's very effective. There's no downside. So, yes, to answer your question, I think it is going to be accepted. There's been several big studies that have shown that it works. They're trying it with inflammatory bowel disorders.
Crohn's
and even weight loss. They're trying it because, again, there's no downside, so why not try it just... throw some shit in there and see if it works.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you have to throw some shit up against the wall and see if it sticks. Literally, actually. We mean that this time. Okay. Who dares to ask another question? Right there in the side.
Whose feces get used in the fecal transplants?
Yes. Ah. Okay. Anyone's will do, is the line that I was told. But they're screened to make sure there's no communicable diseases, there's no HIV, there's nothing that you're going to get from it. And the way that they, Dr. Korutz in Minneapolis is the physician that I visited, he said it's somebody who just never thinks about their digestive tract. Totally, because you can ask a lot of questions, but the simple way is just, how often do you think about your digestive tract? People are like, I don't know, never. Okay, you're good. Yeah, just like, you're good, you're probably good.
Well, I guess you could think of a properly working digestive tract is when you don't have to think about it.
When you don't think about it, when you have no idea
about
that
it,
it's there.
Something's probably wrong.
But you too could be a fecal donor.
Would you like us to get you on some sort of mailing list? We can create one. Everybody who kind of signs up, you know.
There's no simpler way to save someone's life.
And let's think about that. If there was any other research that proved that there was a 90-plus, not treatment rate, but cure rate for a procedure that doesn't cost a lot.
Right.
This is like people who are debilitated.
Yeah,
And how many people die?
30,000 cases in the U.S. per year. So
this lovely plushy thing kills
30,000
people a year.
Yeah.
Because of this. So think of that. And, you know, we just need to get beyond, this is me on my soapbox here, beyond our poo aversion, embrace it, love it.
Yeah, the whole taboo that surrounds the whole alimentary canal, particularly this lower end of it, it doesn't help matters at all. I mean, if you look, anal cancer, no one ever, that was the slogan, it's the cancer no one talks about. It didn't even have its own colored ribbon.
Nobody. And they didn't want brown.
The colon cancer folks didn't want brown.
Right.
So they got blue, but they had to share blue with a lot of other disorders. Whereas brown, they could have had to themselves.
Yeah.
So they should have gone with brown.
It should be brown with little specks of corn in it or something.
She's worse than me. I've never met anybody.
What other chance am I going to get in my life to do something like this with Barry Roach? Okay, questions? Any other questions? Let's do one in the middle and make it hard for you guys. White shirt right in there in the middle. I feel such power I can call on people. You call on the next one.
In an emergency, can you save yourself from dehydration by drinking your own urine?
If you've got one of those reverse osmosis kits where you can get the salt out, and those kits are really simple, and if you have it in your car, then you drink all the urine you want. You are good. You are golden.
We should have kept track and had a contest.
We should have had a contest. Oh. But my understanding is that because of the amount of salt in urine, that it's not particularly helpful, but maybe it's a little better than nothing. I'm not sure. Do you know the answer on that?
I think if you're going to die of dehydration, give it a shot. I wouldn't recommend
nothing
it
to
as
lose.
You know, don't substitute it for like vitamin water. You know, that's my personal non-MD thing. But I think that what about in the packing for Mars?
Packing for Mars, there are different ways to do it, but there's a very simple kind of you're swapping the salt for sugar in a couple of bags. And activated charcoal takes out any objectionable odor, organic materials.
No asparagus on the International Space Station?
No asparagus, and probably not. No asparagus and no beans. Beans are back. Beans are back. But beans were verboten on the in spacecraft for a while. Not because of the smell, but because hydrogen, methane are explosive at certain concentrations. And there was a concern in a confined space that could be fatal. There was actually someone who suggested screening astronauts for their the constituents of their flatus to see if, how much what.
Can you imagine working all your life to be an astronaut and the one thing you were
crossed
grounded,
off the
bad
list.
Flatus? Nope, can't be on the International Space Station.
All right,
more questions. You want to call on the next person?
Let's see. Is there even anybody?
Oh, yeah,
right here. There's one.
Hello. Hello. You happen to have an interesting instrument on your table there. Could you tell us a little bit about it? And there is also another one that I happen to know about. The anal tattooer.
Oh, yeah. I think that is one thing we didn't get time in our part for, which is I have a little bolus to pick with you. And that is, there are a couple of three-word phrases that I came across in your book that, words that I never thought I would see strung together. And I'll give you a hint. It was fermented cow urine.
From
that was one.
Cow urine. Okay.
Rectal beef extract. That was the other. But I think the kicker was sedation-free colonoscopy.
Yes.
Right. And then this is something that you yourself underwent voluntarily.
Yeah. Yep.
But you gave less than a page to it. So I think can you expand on that?
I just felt that it was a little TMI, and for me that's. Well, I will say that in Europe, sedation on demand is the way most people have it done. It isn't that. And I'm small around, so I'm not a good candidate for sedation free. Right. What are you doing?
I'm going to show that you used a flexible. Did you not realize that there was an active part of this interview? No. I'm trying to be a good curator and not grab the instrument with my bare hands.
I'm just impressed at how well your accessories match your dress.
You got to try. Yeah. Now, they did not use something like this. This is actually a proctoscope.
They did not use that, no.
Right. So they used the flexible
item.
The flexible one. But this is something they would have used, a couple decades ago.
It's like a blowgun.
Well, Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
This part would go in, and then they would pull this out, and then you could, see
with
what was going on.
With a little flashlight
in there, yeah. But this was rigid, so there's only so far you could go.
Yeah, and there's some hard turns fairly quickly in the...
Some harder than others.
I am telling you, that would be very painful. Because what is painful with a colonoscopy, the colon doesn't feel, pain from burning or cutting. It's stretching that causes pain. So when they go around a corner, that is when you feel pain. Mm-hmm. But there's not that many... Four or five times you're like, ah! And that's over.
There you go. All right.
So, and then you can go home and I don't know.
All right.
But it was, I feel a need to add this for no apparent reason. And I didn't set this up, but my doctor who did my colonoscopy, my first and only, his name was Dr. Turdeman. And I was talking to the UCSF, PR person because I thought, maybe there's something going on that's new and exciting in colonoscopy. She goes, I'm going to set you up with Dr. Turdeman. I'm like, wait a minute. Rewind the tape. So she said it completely flat. Like, yeah, I'll set you up. You talk with Dr. Turdeman. Maybe would be a good person. I'm like,
I heard of a urologist named Dr. Wellington Hung. So, they exist. I mean, you could just search. I mean, they're really out there. But unfortunately, we are all out of time. I think that just flew by. And so I think... I will say thank you so much for letting me be a part of this.
Oh, no,
and
thank you.
It was so much fun. So, Mary Roach, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.